This is GamesAtWork.biz with Michael Martin and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with.
This is episode 229, 5G Coffee. Hello, this is Michael Martin, co-host, along with Michael Rowe, bringing to you live this recorded version of GamesAtWork.biz on a dreary, cold, and wet March day. Michael, how are you?
I am fine. This is Michael Rowe, co-host, and having a fun, dreary, cold, wet day along with my fabulous co-host, Michael Martin.
Look at that. It's great that the co-hosts are co-hosting.
Woo-hoo.
So on a cold day like today, I like to have a cup of coffee.
I like a cup of coffee on every day.
Well, that goes without saying, right?
Yeah.
So we're starting things off this week with a little bit of a recap from MWC, which is how the Mobile World Congress folks wanted people to refer to MWC. And there was a fun article about the various aspects of robotics that happened at the event this year. And we've talked about robotics on this show quite a bit recently, so not terribly a surprise. And this particular Inverse article was talking about 5G-enabled robotics. And 5G is still a little ways off, or as is 6G, depending on who you talk to.
What about 11G?
11G. It goes up to 11. But it will have a dramatic impact on the ability of connected devices to interact with one another. And robotics is not the least of those, because you won't have all the processing on board on the robot. They'll be on the cloud too. So this Inverse article had a whole bunch of elements to it that I thought were pretty cool. So the first one was this one robot, and I'm trying to remember the name of it now, because
Infos robot, the XR1.
Yes, that's it. The XR1.
And I'm trying to remember, is it Infos? I'm trying to find it in the article. I watched the video
anyway, it's about halfway down. So it's the design of the robot, what I thought was kind of intriguing, and just the ways that the arms were articulated and the big old eyes. We've talked about those sort of things before, and this particular one, at least depending on the model, has like a bow on the front of the face, which I thought was maybe cute, but is what it is. And it was doing a little bit of a hula dance kind of in the beginning to show you the articulation of all the joints. It moved along to show then how this particular robot could grasp objects, especially ones that required a very ginger kind of grasping, like a raw egg, as an example, without crushing it. And then had all these pads on the hand, on the fingers and on the palm of the hand, so the robot could feel and have the appropriate sense of touch to be able to react to people, even to the point of pounding one out with a fist bump, which was kind of a cool thing to do too. What struck you about this particular robot, its articulation, the way it looked, anything, Michael?
Well, it's interesting. So the XR1, I think we talked about on the show in the past that I've had an opportunity to do some work with Pepper,
yes,
which has a similar pedestal design, right? So both of these robots pretty much have kind of, from I guess what you would call the waist down, a pedestal approach with a three wheel base that allows it to move around, but the
the upper torso movement on the XR1 was much more, I hate to use the word articulate again, than Pepper. The hand, as you say, the hand motion was really, really cool. The ability to sense and grasp and all that. What I found the most dramatic about the articulation is how smooth it was. Right. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's why they were showing many different types of dance moves in the attached video to kind of showcase how well it can move. But and the reason that this is the 5G article is you right. send messages up to the cloud for certain other transactions, especially with Pepper, which is the sample that I was playing with was more of a robot designed to be a kiosk, right? An information mm-hmm. kiosk. Yes, I will book a room for you, or you can find that information over in Turnstile 3 or whatever. The XR1 was much more of a motion robot to where you're going to do stuff with its hands and its arms. Both of them have those large eyes, but that's because there are stereoscopic cameras behind those eyes. Obviously, you have some of it from the standpoint of you know, the big friendly eyes like a little puppy, right, to get people engaged better with the robot. But also when you think of all the sensors that are in the face and the head in order to do things like face tracking and things of that nature, you need that. And the 5G aspect, what that really is getting to is latency, right? Right. With all the capability being up in the cloud, having unbelievably low latency from 5G allows you to have that smooth articulation of the robot too. So that's pretty cool. And when I think of some of the early robots, which were very jerky, right? It is night and day. It's fantastic. I'm amazed at how well these things are moving. And you see that in their examples from Mobile World Congress of the barista, right? And it was funny watching the two different examples, right? So there's the Beat robot, which is the other one talked about in the article, which to me is very much like the KUKA robot that we talked about last year that did the rock video, right? Very industrial looking. It's pretty much right. just an arm with an attachment at the end of the arm that allows it to grasp. And then, you know, these unnatural rotations, right? So if you think about it, it picks up the cup and rotates it. If you think the grasper is the hand, it basically rotates the wrist part in more than 360 degrees, which you can't do. You and I can't do personally.
No. Well, not without breaking something.
Correct. And so, and then it would snap back anyway because the skin. that one, the Beat robot, was very effective in kind of picking up and putting the cup down. Mm-hmm. Because of this unnatural hand movement, the XR1 is much more human-like, and it's funny in the example that they show of it actually serving coffee at Mobile World Congress. It grabs a cup of coffee from the one guy, rotates the torso around and puts the cup on the counter, comes back, grabs another cup of coffee, rotates and drops it.
Yeah.
And I was noticing in the video where they were showing some of the other things, you know, like grasping a ball under or grasping a beer glass, etc. It seemed much more that the person was putting it in its hand instead of its hand actually grabbing it from the person.
Yeah, you're right. It was not taking it. It was accepting it.
Right. It was receiving it.
Yes. Yes.
So. Yeah, so that was the interesting thing about the XR1. And if you didn't really pay attention, you probably thought everything was fine. But when you really start looking at it, then you can start seeing, well, this is still in the early phases of development. There are still things that are being worked on. And, well, if you've been to any of these conferences like Mobile World Congress or CES, you have that level of demo capabilities, right? So you got to really focus to see what's going on. And that was the thing that struck me, was the constant placing the thing in the XR1's hands instead of it grabbing it.
Well, right. And I think the other robot, which was in the Twitter piece there too, which is also a coffee serving one. And this one was the B semicolon eat 2E. Is another 5G powered robot that was going around reaching cups of coffee, not spilling them.
Yes, that's and, that's why I called it the beat, right?
Yes. Oh, that's why you call it the beat. Okay.
Yeah, because it's a beat.
The beat. I don't know. So I don't know. I to me that was another intriguing way of not trying to be superhuman in terms of the way that these robots interact one with another. Now, you found a kind of an additional, or did I find this?
You found this one, but I think we saw this one sometime in the past too.
Exactly. There was a robot that allows with the use of a couple of cameras to catch things as they're being thrown at them. So the cameras do all the tracking, and then the arm and the hand, which has got multiple points of articulation, grab it, catch it. And that looked like, whoa, wait a second. Imagine if you combine the two, right? So you've got near instantaneous cloud powered robotics that can calculate the mass, speed, direction of something being thrown, and then being able to handle it and not lose it. So that we'll include that in the show notes so you can see as well. Because, again, audio podcasts, visual things, yeah, that's good fun.
Yeah, that was the I think they called that one the Seeker.
Yes.
Or was that where they had the video from, was a site called Seeker. But the thing there is, those are those industrial robots again. It actually looks like a KUKA arm, even though I don't believe it is, just the way all the articulation is. And then the hand and the algorithms and software that they're using to actually do the tracking and the catching, I think, is what the team that built it is providing the value add on it, right? And you know, the ability to do the tracking in less than 500th of a second, right? So you add the latency of 5G and it probably all still works great. If you add the latency of 4G, it would fail. And that's where it really gets interesting.
Well, what I also thought was intriguing about this was how they trained the robot.
Mm-hmm.
So the video is showing how the researchers for this one actually physically moved the arm to begin to teach it how to do what it needed to do. So it's kind of intriguing to see how the confluence of machine learning along with human assisted learning begins to do what's necessary. Because when you're catching something, it isn't that you're just grasping it. You've got to kind of give it a little bit to absorb the energy so that it doesn't bounce off of what you're trying to grasp it with.
Exactly.
So that was kind of cool. Yeah. Now, talk to us about this Rubik's Cube thing, because I've seen this before from MIT, but not recently.
Yeah, my reason for including this one is was really tying back to the hand tracking one. So what you have is from last year, roughly around this time last year, a group of scientists at MIT were able to build a robot that could solve a Rubik's Cube in a little more than a third of a second.
Right.
So 0.38 of a second. So they had to build a specialized Rubik's Cube that could handle the friction and just the torque of solving it that quickly. And what it does is it has, you know, all the different the things that you need to solve a Rubik's Cube, right? So you have the motion of it, and I'm trying to remember if I think it actually has sensors / cameras in order to figure out how it's going to solve it, right? Because you kind of have to start after you get the top level of a Rubik's Cube's done. I think the rest of it can just be done via math. I don't even think you even need to look at the cube anymore. There's a point where you no longer have to look at the cube to solve it, but you have to look at it to figure out where everything is in order to solve the cube. And so the ability to take the image processing, understand the image, convert that image into an algorithm that then causes a motion to occur that gets you to a new end state. To me, when I looked at this, is exactly what I thought of when I thought of the catching robot, right? The ability to see an image, in this case, a ball coming at you at a certain trajectory and speed, right. And calculate the formula that solves the positioning of the hand to be in the right place to capture the ball, right? And then grasp it. And so it was just another example of how we progress in solving some of these problems. So the Rubik's Cube one, I believe, sets up part of the solving solution that needs to occur in order to get to the point of being able to catch the racket, which then solves a problem around the physics understanding that you need in order to take a cup of coffee and put it on the bar. So it's kind of a path going all the way up into serving coffee with a robot. That's where my head was when I saw this one.
So did you ever take your Rubik's Cube apart and put it back together?
Ultimately, but I used when I was really into them back in, God, was it junior high or high school? The fastest I ever solved one was a little, like right around the 1 minute range.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really good at it at the time. I don't remember some of the moves anymore is the problem. So now if I were to I've got a couple of Rubik's Cubes still. If I were to take to solve them, I probably would, you know, pop a corner off and then just move the pieces in place. Because that's how you did it, right? There were people who would peel the stickers off, but that just makes it look like crap after a while.
Messy. Yeah, that looked
bad. But you could take like a putty knife and pop it in the center pieces on a corner, right? The middle one of the three on one of the corners. And you would pop that out, and then the rest of the pieces would just fall out, and you can put them back into place.
Exactly. Yeah, that's pretty much what I had to do on a regular basis. I lost patience trying to solve it fully back when I was
once you get to a certain point, it was purely a pattern. It truly was, and there were whole books on how to solve it.
Yeah, I never read the books. I just tried to mess with it, and it was like
Think about it, it was so easy to mess them up, so why couldn't it be just put it in reverse and you have it all back?
Yeah, I mean, I did get it set, and then I had a quick thing that would go, and then it would have a nice pattern on it.
Yeah.
And I could go, and then have the pattern just disappear back to the solid sides, and I like that. That was kind of cool.
Yeah.
But you know they're Hungarian, too, by the way, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. And speaking of patterns, you found a really, really cool watch app that allowed you to trigger patterns using MIDI.
What wasn't so much as it triggered patterns so much, but it was this is called MIDI Wrist. So it is a it says control synths from your watch. So what it does is it creates a MIDI controller on your Apple Watch that you can now connect in with your Mac and have it be the way that you start a track, that you add a track, that you can overlay tracks, that you can play them. So the video that I watched on this when I saw it first yesterday is this guy with a guitar who is playing the guitar, uses the watch to start up a recording session. It's like, okay, that's pretty cool. Then uses the watch to go back and play it and record a second track over top of the first one, and then wash, rinse, repeat, does it again. So it's kind of like he's playing three different tracks at once, laying them over one after the other by using his watch. And while part of me is like, well, okay, but he could have done that by just pressing the space bar or something on the Mac or, you know, manipulating it that way. The fact that it's on the watch is incredibly cool. And it just makes it so that you can be a one-person studio that much easier.
So my reaction to that part is what he's done is he's provided the ability to execute macros or keyboard shortcuts via the watch, right? Because the recording a multi-track audio sequence is just that, right? And he's using the watch to, as you say, add a track, mm-hmm. duplicate a track, blah, blah, blah. Where I got more excited was when he's actually using it to manipulate a sequencer. And there's a video with the, what is this thing called? The IK Multimedia something another sequencer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right? And that's where the pattern part is, right? Because sequencers are just patterns, right?
Right.
And he's using the wrist-based controller to, you know, trigger pre-programmed sequences, as an example. And another example, he's actually using it to do, you know, tone shift or switching what the MIDI instrument that's being played, right? And so that's where it got more interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
Having, you know, built a sequencer at Moog Fest and playing around with some of the MIDI stuff anyway, I've got three or four different apps. And we talked about one a while back, which was a open source project to build a full-blown synthesizer on the iPad.
Right.
And I'm totally going blank on the name of it. My brain says it's probably OpenSynth, since it's an open source synthesizer, but I can't guarantee that's what it was called. but if I find it for the show notes, I'll make sure that we have it in there. But it's the ability to use your wrist as a controller is what got me excited about this. I don't think it's worth $499, which is what it costs, because if it truly is just triggering keyboard shortcuts, then meh.
Yeah, well, yeah, but still, the dev ought to get some credit for that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, oh, yeah.
You know?
But if he's doing stuff like it implies in the IK multimedia synth sequencer, and he's actually making changes, that's more interesting to me. Which ultimately, let's face it, what is it actually doing at that point? Well, you're sending a set of keyboard commands or sequence commands into a MIDI controller module on the device that understands the MIDI controller sequencing, right?
Right.
And that's the same regardless of whether you're sending it via from a guitar, a keyboard, a piano keyboard, a drum, yeah, or really your wrist.
So imagine that you could see Blue Man Group all equipped with Apple Watches, and that's how they perform.
What? No tubes?
Well, they could have tubes too, but okay. You know, they could have something with them just playing on the watch. That'd be fun. Oh, I found it, Michael. It's AudioKit Synth 1.
That's it. You got it.
AudioKit Synth 1.
So, highly recommend it.
Rounding out the show for today, we were doing a little recon work, so to speak, of MWC to see what our friend and every so often guest on the show, Ian Hughes, had seen at MWC. And we kind of came across a picture of this very man wearing the HoloLens 2.
Yes.
And I got some email on HoloLens 2, and I'm kind of excited about the increased field of vision that this is bringing to the table. The picture of him wearing it, you know, looks, you know, even cooler than before. Still, you know, easy to put on over glasses, which is an important thing.
Yes.
I'm excited for an opportunity myself to give it a shot and see how it's improved since the first edition.
Yeah, same here. I know. I've got to play with HoloLens. I believe you've got to play with HoloLens also. So I would like to see what they've upgraded on it. I've read all the specs. I watched the video announcement from Microsoft at Mobile World Congress. If you have time, it's a good hour-long kind of keynote, and they go through it in graphic detail. I thought it was very well done. A lot of the use cases make a lot of sense from an enterprise perspective, which is obviously where they're targeting. And, you know, $3,500 for the dev kit versus $5,000 before. And it's now, you know, I don't believe it's tethered at all. I think it's really impressive.
That's moving in the right direction, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So just to kind of wrap up, I don't know, you had talked about on last show a game. Do you remember the game?
Did I?
Yes. You said, this reminds me of a game that has come out with a new version that I played a while back. And it was the...
Fruit Ninja.
Well, the Fruit Ninja was the start, but it was a Adult Swim game.
The Amateur Surgeon.
Amateur Surgeon. So I picked up the new version.
Yes.
What a bizarre game.
it is. So one of the things that was a little frustrating was that you're conducting surgery with your finger. So sometimes the accuracy of where you're making the incision was not exactly where you intended it to be, and that got a little frustrating. So is that better? Is that good now?
Well, if your finger's a chainsaw, yeah, it's fine.
Well, how else are you going to conduct amateur surgery?
The frustrating part now is I've gone through like 8 or 10 surgeries or levels, and I think I'm probably done with it now, because it's obvious that they're setting up to where you're going to end up have to buy stuff just to upgrade your materials to keep going, right?
Oh.
And it's gotten really almost brutal to that level of, oh, you really need to upgrade your pain gel. Oh, you've only got 20 gold and it's 450 gold. Well, you can play level 1 6 more times. Or spend $39 for the startup kit. It's like, really? Are you crazy? So. I don't mind buying games that I enjoy. I refuse to dump money into pay-to-play games.
Yep.
So. It's fun, and I actually have uploaded a video of one of the surgeries in our Slack to be possibly put in the show.
Oh, that's the 245 meg video?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, Slack couldn't handle it, so it kept dying there, which is why I just threw it to you in Skype.
All right, now I see it. It's like, whoa, that's pretty dang big. Well, I'm glad you've had a chance to play some games. I've unfortunately been kind of like, but that's all right. You know, that's why we're here. That's why we're doing the podcast. That's why we're playing games at work.
Yes. Well, thanks everybody for all the feedback of every episode. It is always appreciated, and look forward to our next show when we will continue to play games at work.
See ya.
Bye.
You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network, and we'd like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at GamesAtWork_biz or at our website at GamesAtWork.biz.